The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
Okay, we finished talking about the Tinbergen chapter on the Kittiwake. And I gave you one other chapter to read that's a real fascinating chapter on the jackdaws in Germany, studied by Conrad Lorenz when he was in his early 20s. At least that's when he started. But before that, let's go through the questions I wrote on chapter 1 of the Scott textbook and see what kind of answers you can give me. And if you can't, then I will help you out. What do you think? What was the first need to understand animal behavior humans had, do you think, in the history of human beings?
Humans. Yeah.
Sorry?
They wanted to know about themselves.
No, probably before they ever thought about knowing about themselves.
They wanted food.
Wanted food, that's right. Let's talk about real basic things. They had to hunt. Okay. Now, there are some people that believe we might have evolved as vegetarians, but we seem to have the characteristics of omnivores. We eat meat and fruit and then only recently in human history, grains. So we had to understand something about the animals we were hunting. What do you think was the first animal that actually lived with us, other than our children?
Dogs,
probably. In fact, some people think that they played a key role in early human evolution. That's still pretty controversial. Why else is it useful to know about behavior now? I mean, we still hunt, but that's not so important anymore because almost all the meat we eat is not from hunting. But we still have to know about the animals we care for. Do any of you know about a Dr. Grandin who has redesigned the animal holding areas of meat processing plants because she understood the psychology of the animals, the cattle especially. She's an autistic woman that managed to get a PhD. She overcame enough of her deficits, and she had an amazing ability to think like animals that are captive, and she was able to redesign the pens in a way that so they were less frightened and easier to deal with. So we still have that need, animals for meat. And I think the first answer I got there about understanding our own nature is very important, and many of you want to study animal behavior for that reason, because we like to think of ourselves as the most highly evolved member of the animal kingdom. And most humans wouldn't argue with you, maybe some other animals would. But that's also important. What other reasons? Yeah.
For conservation efforts.
For conservation efforts, too, yes. If any of you have read the book by E.O. Wilson on biodiversity, he's made a strong argument for why it's valuable to conserve animals and plants, the diverse biodiversity of the earth. My computer isn't staying on very long because I didn't bring the power supply, so it's running on batteries. Yes?
I also
want
to know more about nature, because the behavior animals sometimes depend on the weather or whether the earthquake. So
Well, that's true. And that's played a role in human history, too. That's true. This is a question, sort of a thought question, I wanted you to think a little bit about when we study animals in particular. You say this about a lot of other things, too, but why do we need to both be observers and experimenters? Some people that study animals are only observers. They don't actually do experiments. And some experimenters don't do much observation. I discovered that as a young graduate student here at MIT, that people would design experiments without, and they would design the experiment to do with a rat, usually, without ever observing the rat. They just designed the experiments, they would buy the animals and run the experiment. They were studying boxes with animals in them. Why is it important to do both? I didn't. That was the time I got started observing hamsters. I spent a lot of time observing them before I ever did experiments with them. Yeah,
there's one on.
Okay, you say in their natural context. That makes special demands, of course, because many animals that we, animal behaviors, spend a lot of time studying, we never observe them in their natural context.
Yeah, so not all observational studies are able to work, but the more like a natural context you can have for an observational study, the more you'll learn about how.
What do we do experiments for?
Let me answer.
I'll let someone else.
With the experiments, we're going to figure out more precisely exactly what is involved. Because if you just observe an animal, maybe it's doing one thing, but you're not entirely sure why.
Yeah, okay. So basically, you do your observations. So you know a lot about the details of what animals do, and that might give you ideas about why he does it. You might have ideas about what causes it. For example, if we're just behaviorists, we're not studying the brain, we might, there's still a lot of cause-effect questions we can answer. And that's without ever dealing with the function of the behavior and why it evolved. Okay. But to understand a lot of those things, we have to do experiments, even to understand the function properly. And we'll have many examples of that throughout the whole term. But don't underplay the value of either one. And the one we at MIT type people tend to undervalue is the observational set. People will start in with experiments and questions about cause and effect without knowing that much about the organization of behavior. That's why I like to spend time at the beginning of the class on ethology. Okay. Some people think that, in fact, we don't need the animals that much anymore because we can simulate behavior with a computer. So do you think they'll replace the study of the living animal? What's the value of these computer simulations? Does anyone have any experience with computer simulations? You want to try it?
I don't have experience with them, but right. If you can do computer simulations, it's a lot more cost-effective. But you still are going to need to do the animals.
Well, what are you doing? What are you simulating? I mean, what is guiding your simulation?
Whatever data you first collect on.
Is it data? I mean, that's what the text says. He says your simulations are never better than your data. But I would argue with that. What are the simulations based on? What do you use when you write a program?
Observational studies.
No, you use algorithms. You need rules. You need hypotheses about what's causing the behavior. So, for example, I've done computer simulations of behavior. I did it with Bruce Blumberg of the Media Lab, and I'm a graduate student here at MIT, Song-Yi Yoon. Bruce has an amazing programs where he simulates behavior of animals, or actually screen creatures. They look like little animals running around the computer screen, and they look like it's a cartoon he's playing. But that's not what it is. It's the program directing the movements of the little creature on the screen, which may be look like a human, or a cartoon of a human may look like a little animal, is a whole theory of motivated behavior. Bruce got started with this by taking my graduate student class a number of years ago. And we spent a lot of time, especially on the ideas of Conrad Lorenz. And I was pretty sure at that time that if he could formulate the rules that Lorenz talked about, and some people made fun of Lorenz's model, but I didn't, because I knew that he may have a quaint way of putting it, like his flush toilet model of motivation. But in fact, it was a good model, the way motivation works. And if he could put it into the software, he could then use it as the engine driving the actions. And he needed to separate the motor system, separate behavioral organizations, organization of different kinds of behavior, but then he had to have a way to represent motivation. So the animal would change his behavior from time to time, his motivational states would change depending on inputs and what he's doing. And Bruce did that. He was able actually to test certain ideas about simple kinds of behavior. He simulated hamsters for a while, for example. That was before he worked with a graduate student that worked with me also. He did some simulations. The problem is that's never really been developed well. It's really the computational approach to animal behavior. It's never been developed. Bruce did it for a while, and then he works at the Media Lab, so his interest is in making new things that look nice and that can sell things and this and that the way the Media Lab does. But it wasn't, he likes the idea of using it as a scientific model, but that's not his main business. He's actually a wonderful computer programmer and a good engineer. But I think that there is a future in that kind of work, but it's a huge amount of work, and maybe we don't know enough details about many aspects of behavior anyway to be doing it. Though I think to understand brain organization and how it organizes behavior, these models would be extremely useful. Maybe just for the organization of behavior itself. Maybe we're not ready for that. It would be nice. I can talk to Bruce and see if I can get him to talk in the class so you could see some of those things. He could show us. How many of you think that would like me to try? Is that something that interests you? Most of you. I'll talk to him and see. All right. Okay, now this question about Tinbergen's questions, they were covered in the video we saw, and they were covered again in this chapter. So you should be able to tell me now what they were. Somebody else. How about one of you guys?
Your questions are the causation of the animal behavior, the evolution of the behavior.
What does causation mean?
Why does the animal do this particular behavior?
Okay, so from a behavioral point of view, we may not be talking about brain, but we'll be talking about the stimuli that elicit the behavior. We'll be talking about when it occurs, so on and so forth. What's next?
The evolution.
Okay.
The function.
And of course, to a sociobiologist, the function is pretty strongly linked to evolution, but in the chapter by Scott, he emphasized evolutionary history, okay, which is an important question to many ethologists in particular. Okay, one more.
Development,
okay. Why is that important? Why do you think it's so important to understand development of some particular behavior? Maybe we can come up with an example. Remember the stickleback. There were different examples used in the text, but then the video had particular things. Maybe we should start with causation. What causes the male to initiate his zigzag dance, his courtship dance? Remember? What, there's a key stimulus that triggers the onset of the behavior.
Yeah. The hormones?
The hormone, that's part of the answer, and that's important. The hormonal levels are not right.
From seeing the female has to.
The female has to appear a certain way. Do you remember?
The large
belly and large red swollen appearance, the female. Remember, the larger females elicited behavior more readily. Okay. So what was the function of the zigzag dance? It has a specific function. Now, you can answer that in different ways. You want to try? That's the first function that we need to know. It plays a role in that sequence of behavior. Okay? And then you could talk about the longer range function, results in reproduction and so forth. But its specific function here is to attract the female.
Possibly analogous to some human behavior.
Oh, yeah. Perhaps more, the sequence is very rigid in comparison to human courtship. But what about evolution? Do you remember how did he get at the question of evolution of these behavior patterns? He didn't talk about the zigzag dance in the video. Remember? Yeah, he did comparative studies, in a word, looking at different populations, as you said. Remember one in Canada and one, I don't remember where the other one was, probably Europe, but there's many different populations. Some of them, the Canadian population, have been isolated from the European population for a long, long time. Okay. And they had evolved some differences in their behavior. And then why did he find development to be an important question to understand stickleback behavior? Remember, he looked at the role of experience in development in anti-predator behavior, yes?
Was the fish that has parents but escaped its paws and corrupt way was an orphan stickleback fish?
Yeah, the male actually protects the young from the... It's a strange fish in that the females will eat the babies. And it's the male that does all the rearing. And he has to protect them from the females. And so the ones that swim up off the bottom where they're more vulnerable, that is, they're more vulnerable if they're up off the bottom of the lake. He literally grabs them in his mouth and spits them back into the nest. Whereas the females grab them in their mouths too, but they don't spit them back in the nest, they swallow them. Okay, so, but Tinbergen found out that those little fry learn basically to evade that capture. And without the experience with the male, they don't learn it as well, so more of them die. And they have done experiments to show that. But anyway, we can ask those kinds of questions about any behavior pattern. Yes?
Well, I was just wondering, like, with this kindergarten core question. Like, why do we ask them? Because it kind of seems like all of them have the same answer.
They don't all have the same answer. There are different approaches, and you, if you have all those questions in mind, it helps you formulate the questions about to ask about behavior. But you're right, they're very closely related. And we can't, some of them we can't answer one of them without dealing with the other two. It just depends on which aspect of behavior you're talking about, but that's a good point. Now, Scott didn't answer this question, but I wanted you to think about it. He said that he talks about adaptation. We know that behavior patterns evolve because, usually, the main way they evolve is because they're adaptive. And that, what does adaptive mean here to an evolutionist? It means that by performing such behavior, he will leave more offspring. That's what adaptive means. But that implies a lot of other things. It implies survival. If you don't survive, you don't leave more offspring. If you survive after you've had offspring, how's that going to help with the offspring? Well, it might. You might, after you've had your offspring, you might be important still for raising the young and so forth. But how could a behavior pattern become or be maladaptive in nature? Yes?
If the conditions change somehow.
Okay, that's probably the first part, important part of the answer. Conditions change. Sorry?
Like deer freezing in a headlight.
Yeah.
If they get run over.
Deer and dogs and other animals, that's right. Because they didn't evolve to evade headlights. If headlights were a major part of the life of all deer, what would happen in their evolution? The ones that didn't freeze as much, their genes would become more and more dominant in the population, and eventually they might avoid headlights. But that's right. It's when things change. What other things can change? Yeah. Okay, a genetic change could occur that is maladaptive, but then what would happen? You would get fewer offspring, the trait would probably disappear. But some evolved traits, in fact, and this is perhaps the more difficult part of the question, that sometimes we evolve a trait that's adaptive, but then has certain maladaptive aspects, and that seem to be necessary for its evolution. That can happen, and there will be examples of that when we study sociobiology. What kind of change is most likely to lead to maladaptive behaviors? In a word, rapid change. Things that change suddenly and drastically. And that in nature, it doesn't always involve humans, okay? And we know that humans are the major factor causing the change in the environment that animals have to live in. But new predators can appear, for example. New predators can move into an area. A predator lacking one kind of food, his food supply disappears, can start attacking other animals. So suddenly those animals will have a new predator. Okay? And some of them may not, because of certain behaviors they show, might not be able to avoid the predator. In other words, his behaviors will become maladaptive. Okay, then here's a more specific question. If you read that chapter, it's about the black-headed gulls. Tinbergen had discovered that when the eggs hatch in the nest, the The black-headed gull's parents don't remove them immediately. They wait a little while, and then they remove those eggshells from the nest, and they put them at some distance from the nest. And the question is why? Well, we don't want you to say because they want to. Yes, they want to, but they don't have to be aware of the why we're asking. Okay? Of course, they remove them because they want to. That just means they are motivated to do that. But why did that evolve? Yes?
They said that the one that blew it away.
Okay, so he actually did an experiment, remember? Can you describe the experiment? He set up an artificial colony of nests, okay, with eggs in them, that he could then measure the amount of predation in these different nests. And he put eggshells in some of them. He put eggshells at varying distances from the nest. And he looked at how often the eggs were attacked in the nest. And the findings were, I didn't bring the picture, but it's right there in the book. The further the eggshells had been removed from the nest, the less predation there was. It wasn't that it dropped to zero. I mean, the herring gulls still came in and grabbed their eggs and other predators. But what is it about eggshells that's so bad?
I was just wondering, first, is that an example of an adaptive and also an maladaptive trait? Because when they're taking the eggshells away, they're leaving the chicks more vulnerable.
Very good point. He's talking about a maladaptive aspect of the behavior of the adult gull. That it has to leave the chicks and not protect them for a little while so it can remove the eggshells. And he pointed out that, yeah?
If that is in blue, the eggs outweighs the rest of the human body.
So it's a matter of a costs and benefits, right? And apparently the cost of doing it when they're first born is too great, so they wait a little bit, even though the chance of predation is higher. Because they have to dry off. They're apparently too easy to swallow when they're still wet. And they're more preyed on right at that period, right after they're born. So they wait a little while, the chicks dry off, and then the adults expose them to predators by removing the nest. But by doing it, I mean, so a few of them get caught. But once the eggshells are removed, they're not as easy to detect. Why? Because of their camouflage, the nest and the chicks in it are camouflaged, but those open eggs are easier to detect visually. Okay, so that's why it pays for those birds to remove the eggshells from the nest, in spite of that cost. Okay, so a lot of times that's what you're dealing with when you ask these kinds of questions. You're dealing with a cost-benefit equation. Okay, so we're dealing there with the function and primarily the functional question. Now, I'm sure you've heard of imprinting before, and it was mentioned at the end of this chapter, but without too much detail. How many of you have seen the films of Lawrence or other people demonstrating imprinting? How many of you have seen those before? Maybe. Would you like me to find a film and bring it on Friday? Okay. I don't know if we'll do it on Wednesday, but I like to do those kinds of things on Friday. And it's difficult to bring that thing over here. But I think it might be possible to bring just the video thing and plug it into that and not have to bring that huge monitor. So I'll see if we can do that. Then it would be easier for me to show videos more often. But okay, I will try to find it. So what is imprinting and why is it unique? Does anybody know from your reading? If they've not seen it? Yes, do you know?
It's been observed in the group that, through a crucial time period, right after they're born.
Okay, so there's a critical period in the learning.
And it's like, and they have experiments where they have to have a guy dress up in a suit, and they have feed him, shakes up a hand that looks like a bird and everything. So if those birds are put back into the mouth, they won't be socially awkward.
Because they can imprint on, they usually, of course, imprint on their parents, on the parent that's there with them, and they, during that critical period. But if the parent isn't there, for example, if you're hand-rearing them, like Conrad Lawrence hand-rearing jackdaws, then they will imprint on humans. And so it can become maladaptive. Why is it so unique, this kind of learning? It's an amazing kind of learning. It seems to be a perceptual learning. It's learned very rapidly. Yes?
It seems to happen mainly in a particular spot in the bird's life. It's
That's right.
Young.
It happens just in one period of life. Do you think there are things like that for us, for humans? Do we imprint? A lot of that is not perfectly known. You know, it doesn't appear to be the same kind of imprinting you get, say, in chicks or ducks or geese. But we certainly have some learning processes that are similar to that. If you look at mammals, there is a kind of imprinting on odors. The female sheep, for example, shows imprinting, that is, the mother shows imprinting on the odor of the female, of the offspring, sorry, and becomes attached to her own offspring as opposed to somebody else's offspring. Okay. Whereas the young, say a hamster, becomes very attached to the particular odor of its nest and its mother. Okay. So very early in life, it's got an inbuilt attachment to any warm area. It doesn't, in fact, have temperature regulation yet. It's like a reptile when it's born. And it is highly motivated to go to the warmest area. That's not imprinting. It's just built-in behavior. It's innate behavior. But then, when it's about 8 days old, it switches. The temperature tether changes to an olfactory tether, and it's attracted to the odor of its mother's nest. It appears to be a kind of olfactory imprinting. So it does occur in mammals too. Did anybody learn anything else about imprinting? Yes?
Apparently, I should have read the fish as well.
In fish?
Yeah, some kind of olfactory imprinting in salmon, which helps them go back to the streams where they respond so that they can reproduce.
I don't know if it shows all the characteristics of imprinting. It probably does. It's well known, this behavior, the homing behavior of salmon. They sniff their way back up the right river to the right place to spawn. Yes? Anybody else? Okay. We have a little more time, so we're going to at least get started with King Solomon's ring. A story that Lawrence began by describing play behavior in jackdaws. Do you remember that? They fly up very high, and they dive down, and they don't seem to have any particular purpose other than play, and they usually do it with each other. It's a beautiful description of a kind of play behavior in animals. So I want you to think about it. What's the adaptive function of play, and which animals do it? We know all humans play. What other animals play? Yes?
A lot of small cats will play.
Cats, okay. But you said small cats.
And big cats. I was thinking about house cats, but I realized that lions and tigers.
Right. In general, animals do it more when they're young. Okay. But some adults do it. Not all species. Well, in not all species will the adults play. In apes, for example, the little apes will play and play and play. And some of the adults, particularly the alpha male, will be very tolerant of them, but it won't enter in too much to the play. It's not been studied in perhaps as much detail as would be good to do it, the role of play in adults. But it is certainly a juvenile behavior in all the mammals that have been studied. You see it in hamsters, rats, mice, any mammals that have been looked at in detail. And what kind of behavior do we see when they're playing? We usually see at least fragments of adult-type behavior. Okay. It's like they're practicing for what they're going to do later. Why is that so important? Why would it be important to practice behaviors that are already built in? But cats, we know that cats have innate predatory behavior, and yet the young kittens, you will see it in their play. And the answer hasn't been that easy to get, but in detailed studies of cats by Lehausen, and I don't know if I could, his writings are difficult, but I'll try to pull out some selections to read later. He describes beautifully how these animals have to learn to link up different elements of their behavior patterns. Each pattern is built in, but they're not all linked, they don't form a coordinated sequence that allow the animal to get food. Now, some of that apparently is put together during play behavior when they're growing up, and we certainly do a lot of that when we're growing up. In general, learning coordinated movement is important, but other functions have been proposed. One is to maintain the brain circuits. Circuits, when they're not used, if we don't use it, we lose it. And there is evidence that that happens for at least some brain pathways. So if we don't use it in play or in reality, in real behavior, it'll be lost. So that may be another role in development.
Jared, something we had talked about, I remember a great conversation about play, the idea that it's reinforcing, playful, it's reinforcing for behaviors that when they get older are going to be scary and painful. So when they do it, they set up circuits where it's fun, so they're more likely to engage in it when there's going to be some pain involved.
Yeah, that's a possible reason.
Maybe we were left with questions about that.
Yeah. It's still an understudied area. One area that's been studied particularly extensively in humans is to look at sex differences in play. Little boys play differently than little girls, and they've looked at that in many different species and found it true in monkeys and apes and rats and mice and any animals they've looked at it in detail. They see some male-female differences in play behavior. And when a play fighting can change to real fighting very easily, but usually when they're very young, it never changes to real fighting. But when they're, say, teenagers, and I don't know, you might recall it in your own upbringing, it reaches a point where somebody gets a little too rough or something, and it can suddenly change into a real fight. And that you see the same thing in animals. It's particularly dangerous to play with large pets, dogs. Some people keep mountain lions as pets and things like this. And they learn to play with them when they're kittens. They're perfectly safe when they're very young. But the older they get, you know, the animal will sometimes cross the line between the play behavior and the real behavior. And then, of course, you can get hurt. Usually when that happens, that may be what stops play behavior. Inability to, when the behavior becomes integrated enough to have the function of the adult behavior.
South Africa, I saw, was at a zoo, an open zoo, where they had the baby lions, cubs, cute. You could touch them. And they had a runt hyena with them, and they played equally. And the person who was there said, it changes within a 2-month period. They suddenly, that hyena, they prey on it. They exercise it from the group. And so it was a short frame where their brains suddenly say, this is no more play with that thing that looks different. And it's just dramatic to see that.
And yet, animals sometimes, there's some animals that if they're reared with other species, they'll maintain. There are dogs that never attack cats, for example, if they've been raised, or at least they won't attack particular cats that they've been raised with. But maybe that, I don't know if that requires reward from the humans taking care of them or not. But you do find examples of that too. But among wild animals, I think what David said is the more usual. Okay. What property of the jackdaws, about all jackdaws, makes them such interesting pets? Or at least what made them so interesting to Lawrence? He talks about this. And then I want to know about other species people keep as pets that might be similar. Yes. Very social animals. Okay. And it's the social animals that make the best pets because they can socialize with humans. And if they go beyond the period in their growing up where they become, we say they become socialized, they develop their social habits, then it's much more difficult to make pets of them. Okay. That's why you can't just catch a wild wolf. But if you catch a wolf cub, okay, then you can raise it and you can make a pet out of it. Okay. But not once it's beyond that point. But any animals that are, if you think about the animals we keep as pets, the ones that are the most social make the best pets. I think rats, if that's true, rats should be much better pets than hamsters.
They are.
That's probably true. Because you can interact with the rat more, right?
Yeah.
Hamster's a solitary animal.
One of my rats went to sleep in his cage in the middle of the night, and I woke up with it curled up next to my neck on my pillow.
Whereas a young hamster might do that, but the hamster would... The hamster, yeah, the hamster will ignore you generally. The hamster looks cuddly and so forth, so that's why people like it as a pet. It's like a little teddy bear, but in fact they're not very social animals. Okay, so... This is a very nice quotation that Lawrence makes. He's very concerned about this issue of the interaction of inherited and acquired elements of the behavior of the animal he's studying. And he said that they, like a mosaic, they have to be pieced together to form a pattern. But if you rear a bird by hand, the natural harmony of this design, where innate and acquired elements will become interwoven, somewhat disturbed. And I want examples of that in his jackdaw. Can you remember?
The example of the male that David would have
with them.
The male trying to mate with them. And I particularly like the one of the male trying to coax him into his shirt pocket in the nest, right? Because the male had imprinted on Lawrence. See, then humans were the sexual object when the animal matured. Or the other example. Remember Jock? Turned out to be a female. And who did Jock fall in love with? His housemate, yes. So when she moved, she left his employment, moved to another village. Suddenly Jock disappeared and he flew to the other village. You know, took up residence with his former housemate. And the other cute one is the, you know, the male jackdaws will feed the female. So it talks about this male trying to feed him. And it actually says directed at his mouth initially, and he actually accepted the minced worms for the sake of his studies. But when he didn't open his mouth, then he would get his ears packed with the food. The jackdaws trying to court him, you see. So it gets pretty mixed up. And you see some of that in dogs too, because when we raise dogs, they are becoming socialized with humans. Okay? So they literally think they're humans. You know? Just like those jackdaws. They behave like they're a member of the humans. Or they think he's a jackdaw. And that's actually the way the dogs are treating us too. Like we're a member of the pack. No. And in dogs, it's particularly important because of the hierarchy, the social hierarchy they form, and they're big animals, that they are not the alpha male. If you let a male dog think he's the alpha male, you're in big trouble. So you have to dominate them. Okay. And some people keep dogs don't understand that. They want to be very nice to them. And suddenly they can be dealing with an animal that thinks he's the boss. And they can be dangerous.